Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 3 issues for just £5. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome to The Critic's podcast. In this week's podcast, The Critic's political editor, Graham Stewart, speaks with The Critic's sketch writer, Rob Hutton, about how political journalism has changed in the last 2 decades and the role that technology has played in its evolution.
Rob Hutton, you've been 22 years as a political journalist. I think at the beginning of your time, perhaps political journalism had not changed in the previous 20 years, but we look in the succeeding 20 or more years and we see a total change. 22 years ago, when you joined The Mirror, was reporting politics quite old school?
Yeah, no, I mean, I joined The Mirror as a general reporter, I doubt it had changed massively in that century, to be honest. We still worked to overnight deadlines. There was no Twitter. The internet did exist, but only barely. I mean, it existed in the sense of you'd sort of send emails. I'm not even sure that The Mirror had a news website when I joined it. It felt recognisable. I mean, I one of my favourite books as a teenager was Scoop, which I still reread from time to time. And actually, it was broadly recognisable. You had satellite phones, you had mobile phones. Things had changed. You weren't filing by telegram anymore, but you were still filing copy over the phone. So
when did that stop?
There's an interesting debate about who was the last person to file a story to copy takers. But I was still filing to copy takers in the year 2000. You'd phone somebody up and dictate your story down the phone to a fast typist. Which actually was a brilliant discipline, because you would hear your story out loud and you'd...
But you would write it or type it out first and then...
You'd write it in your pad.
Or would you be kind of doing it live and changing your mind as you speak?
So that's a really interesting question. When you first start doing it, you write it all out and then you read it down, and then quite rapidly you move to a point where you're writing sort of notes, or you write the intro and then... You've got your points that you want to hit. I mean, I remember when I was doing it for the Edinburgh Evening News in the mid-90s, doing festival reviews, you'd read your review and you'd say 4 stars, and the woman at the other end of the phone would say, that sounded like a 3-star review to me. And you, yeah, okay, 3 stars, you know. And actually what it taught you was even as you would... speaking, you'd hear yourself doing it and you'd think, oh no, that can be tighter. Because the great skill I've always thought in news reporting is you're telling the story to somebody, and the physical act of actually telling the story to somebody who is a disinterested copy taker who's been listening to this stuff all day, it makes you quite aware that the next thing you were going to say is actually quite boring. We could probably skip that. I mean, the sort of the... apocryphally, I'm not sure that anyone ever said this to me, although it is the title of my unwritten memoirs, is that you knew you were in trouble when the copy taker said, is there much more of this? That was the clue. You had to tell your story in a way that would interest the person at the other end of the phone. And it was amazing, and we've lost that. It's rather like novels have got longer because people type them out on word processors rather than on typewriters. And when you typed on typewriters, if you decided the page was rubbish, and you couldn't face typing it again. Whereas when you're typing on a word processor, oh, well, I'll just cut all of that and maybe I'll bring it back in or something. So sort of technology has led to books expanding, and it's sort of led in a funny way to journalism, I think, getting less pithy.
When I first joined the Times newspaper 20 years ago, one of my early tasks was to write about a commemoration of the Dunkirk evacuation, which I thought I had 1,000 words, and I I wrote historically balanced piece, which I was very proud of. I put in all sorts of dramatic details. And the next day, when I opened the Times, it was to find it had been cut to about 400. and it was basically say that there was a German attack, the British evacuated, and some of them got home. Yeah. But in a way, the dynamic between those who feel they're literary figures and a well-established author and journalism, how remote are these two things? I mean, one wants to write for the ages, and yet the process of journalism is very instant.
I've always been quite happy writing stories on the basis. I've always quite liked the idea that their tomorrow is chip wrapping, which, you know, especially now nobody's buying newspapers at all. They're clearly not, but I was always happy with the idea that we're just writing it for the readers right now. And when I was then writing books, I viewed that as something completely different. And although I think I took to it the disciplines that I had picked up in reporting, in the sense that when I did my last book, which is about MI5, I was very conscious that I couldn't report, I didn't want to write anything that I couldn't show that I knew. And I not everyone has that view, but if you'd spent, as I had at that point, I mean, I've spent 16 years at Bloomberg before I was in this job, you get quite imbued with the sense that you can't write it if you can't show it. You know, if you're not sure about it, don't do it. And you carry that with you. Clearly not all books are written to that standard. Indeed, not all journalists have that standard. But
I worry, Rob, that us journalists have got a little bit above ourselves, by which I mean people read newspapers, or in the old days, people read newspapers to find out what was going on. They didn't, you know, if you picked up a newspaper in the 1920s or 1930s, you didn't have Rob Hutton on the rights and wrongs of the Stresser Agreement or Mussolini's invasion of Abyssinia. It was just reported that Italy had invaded Abyssinia. And you were invited to draw your own conclusions from the reports of the atrocities that followed. Has there been a real sense in which literature has overtaken journalism in a way which has diminished journalism as a strict reporting of facts?
I'm not sure about I'm not sure about literature. There's always been a thing in journalism that it would be a good thing to be a star, that it would be a good thing to be a name, rather like the sort of the Hollywood thing of being a name of the name above the title. To be a star reporter was a good thing. But I mean, to be a star reporter was a good thing on the Mirror when I joined 20 years ago. We had star reporters, and their bylines were bigger than my bylines. Photo bylines, we would call them. Oh. And what I think there's been an acceleration, for want of a better word. We now go through 4 news cycles a day. You know, I noticed it this morning. I sort of felt like I had covered yesterday in Parliament. And when I looked at the news this morning, I discovered that overnight Number 10 had briefed another line out. Now, in my previous job, I would have had that. And there you are. There's another news cycle that took place between 5:30, I think the Prime Minister stopped speaking last night, and 10:30. They managed to squeeze another whole story in about testing, and that's quite normal. Now we have a sort of an overnight news cycle, and then between 7 and 9 a.m. there's another little news cycle based on the morning broadcast round by a minister going around the studios, and then by about 1 o'clock, there's been another news cycle based on the morning lobby briefing, and then there's an afternoon one based on something happening in Parliament, and then there'll be the overnight briefing. So how many is that? That's 4 or something.
There's a lack of mystery in this, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which, I mean, the more government makes itself available, or at least by putting out its line, the less we're really interested in anything it has to say, and the less a sense of moment it is when government whether from a minister or from a spokesperson actually says anything.
Yeah, I think, I mean, even on Saturday, so last Saturday we had this Saturday morning, the Times and the Mail, I think, had reported that the government was going to introduce another lockdown. There was a bit of a panic across the course of the morning, and then sort of on Saturday afternoon we learned there was going to be a press conference, and then that was delayed. But by the time the press conference started, which I think was about 6:45, we knew everything that the Prime Minister was going to say, because that had been briefed out to the broadcasters. So the story, in a weird way, for me watching it at 7 p.m., watching the Prime Minister at 7 p.m., was not what he was saying, because I had known by that stage for 2 hours what the broad contents of the lockdown would be. And I mean, indeed, there had been a long, long briefing, I think, for reporters that afternoon. So what are you, as you say, you know, sort of, you're no longer waiting for the Prime Minister to announce something. About the only time now where we are genuinely sort of, where we genuinely get news from the mouth of the politician is in the budget, which is the one thing, and even then, a lot of it's been briefed beforehand. I mean, that's the one thing I can think of where you have my former colleagues at Bloomberg would be literally sitting there sending headlines as the Chancellor speaks, because there are things that the Chancellor is saying that are not public, that are not known until he says them.
I mean, for the likes of Bloomberg, the Chancellor's comments are gold. But for many of the members of the Cabinet, really, this is the come and go of normal daily politics. I wonder if you went back to the 1930s, 1920s, where, in essence, if politicians had something to say, they said it in Parliament first. Mm. They didn't talk to the equivalents of Bloomberg, if there were equivalents. And so these things were not dealt then. Has that fundamentally changed the way in which there's a relationship, a chumminess between journalists and politicians who they want to leak things? And actually, these things should be in released to Parliament first, and then it's journalists' role to report Parliament.
Yeah, we're not in that world anymore. I mean, we're just not in that world anymore. We had even the Prime Minister's words to Parliament yesterday were briefed overnight in advance. Some of them, I think. So we go through this sort of this funny kind of thing where, I mean, the four cycles I talked about earlier, one of them is the Prime Minister will say, one of them is the Prime Minister is saying, and one of them is the Prime Minister has said, and then we move on to, you know, sort of to the next thing. And almost you've got, by the time the Prime Minister is speaking, you've already moved on to the next story. There's a great desire to move the story on, as news editors up and down the country will be saying to reporters tomorrow morning, how are we going to move the story on? And it's very difficult in those circumstances to say, well, let's just, why don't we just let the story, why don't we just report the story that we have? This looks perfectly good. I think partly because in the household in which I was growing up, the Times would be pushed through our letterbox at 7 o'clock in the morning. And my father would read it over his breakfast, and there's a whole, that was when he would learn a whole load of things, and then he would go to work, and he'd come home in the evening, and he'd watch the 9 o'clock news, and he'd learn some other things, and then his next news cycle was the Times the next morning, and in between those things, he was getting on with his job, and now, even if you're not listening to broadcasts, even if you're not watching 24-hour news, it's very, very hard to escape this, as I say, this just this sort of this acceleration.
Well, this is the great difficulty, isn't it? In that it's a push-pull. Do we worry about the nature of politics and politicians because they're constantly responding to 24-hour news and coming out with glib and perhaps unconsidered statements? Or is there, we don't need to blame journalists for this, we just have to accept that the state of the market, that there is a market for 24-hour news, and it's journalists' role to be constantly probing. I do wonder whether actually something has been lost, and we should be more respectful of our legislators, and just say that some of them need time to come to a conclusion, and by constantly pressing on them, we are actually, as journalists, just being Twitter.
Yeah, no, and I think that's true. There are times when you're sort of phoning people up and you think, well, to ask them what they think of a document, you think, well, I mean, really, this document's only been out for 10 minutes, and, you know, I'm not sure the person I'm talking to is a terribly fast reader, and probably they haven't read it, and, you know, and maybe they would never have read it. Certainly some of the MPs I know that's true of, but you're not giving them a chance to think, and you're not giving them a chance to do their job, and you almost respect the ones, you do respect the ones who say, do you know what, I haven't read it.
Do prime ministers or chancellors or foreign secretaries have a chance to think in the modern 24-hour news media?
Well, I think they can, in the sense of certainly chancellors. I mean, it's slightly the question of how much you can submerge your submarine. I think it's more difficult for prime ministers, because there is an expectation that the prime minister spokesman will have a view on any subject under the sun, and you will have been to lobby briefings where the prime minister spokesman turns up with a thick binder, and reporters will throw the ball on whatever question, and the spokesman will sort of feel down his tabs and will duly turn to Coronation Street or Iran or the bond market or whatever it is you're asking about, and will offer a view. And actually, sometimes, to be fair to the Prime Minister's spokesman, the answer will be, I have not had a chance to ask the Prime Minister what he thinks about Corrie or whatever. Although, equally, then the answer will be, well, look, can we get a line for this afternoon?
But this is the fault of journalism.
Yeah.
It is of no moment that the Prime Minister, whoever he or she may be, has a line on Corrie. It is perhaps a moment that the Prime Minister has a sense of what the cost of lockdown will be, which we've just discovered today that there's been no impact assessment for. I worry that those of us, you and me included, in the media are really holding politicians to unreasonable standards.
So there's a weird thing, and I've seen it now a number of times, where a government in waiting will say, oh no, we're not going to play this game. You know, David Cameron had a lovely line about it. You know, the government as part of, I can't remember, it was something like the government as part of a sort of demented part of the entertainment industry. You know, and I remember hearing him say that in 2008, 2009, thinking, yeah, you're not wrong. You know, that sort of the government felt that it had to sort of constantly be dancing to this tune. And then you get into government, and the ability to say, do you know what, we're still thinking about what we think about this, come back to us next week, it's very hard to hold that line. And it's very hard to hold that line partly because then you sort of create a vacuum where somebody else who has reached a conclusion, whether a good one or not, offers it. And it's also partly difficult to hold that line because not all politicians are tremendously thoughtful people. Many of them won't come to better thoughts if given a week than they would if you ask them, you know, what they think in 2 minutes. I mean, we have had, you know, the subject of the national debate for the last 4 years has been how international trade works. How many members of parliament who have been members of parliament for 4 years really understand the minutiae of international trade? The most important thing that any of them really can understand at the moment, many of them cannot be bothered to do the reading, and giving them more time to not do the reading will not get you better answers. And I think there's an extent to which that's true even within government, actually. So although, yes, there has been a great acceleration, yes, that is... I mean, there's a way in which that's the fault of journalists. That's a way in which just, you know, I mean, I would... I think, I don't know many journalists who would not cheerfully go back to only filing once a day, those glory days, rather than sort of having to have a I mean, you know, we'd say the budget at Bloomberg, we would have to have a story on the budget running more or less as the Chancellor sat down, and a proper story on the budget. Mm. You know, that's a... But that's just the world that we live in. So we're sort of... That's what readers demand, and even... I mean, I'm sort of conscious, I'm now working for what's supposed to be a sort of a slower news outfit, but we sort of want the sketch to run on the day that the thing happens.
You work for the Mirror, you work for Bloomberg, you're now a sketch writer for The Critic. What is the difference in writing for a tabloid newspaper, writing for a financial-minded news agency, and writing for a magazine with a political analysis?
Writing for The Mirror, we ran stories over 400 words. We didn't run a lot of stories over 400 words, so... You were writing extremely tight copy. I mean, as I say, I was writing for The Mirror in an age when it barely had a website. And you could go... I mean, I remember I covered a plane crash, quite a nasty one, and I had the day to go and cover the plane crash, and then I went back to the office and wrote the story. That was in 1999. I just actually can't imagine that how many iterations of the story. I think I got the phone call at about 11 o'clock, and I think I started writing copy at about 4:30 or something, and maybe I filed that by phone. I can't remember. But how many iterations of the story would I have written by 4:30 these days? I mean, so many.
Let me give you an analogy from the early 2000s, where before really the 24-hour news cycle became absolutely the run of the day. Concorde crashed.
I remember that.
2000.
Yeah.
I was a Times leader writer at the time.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, Concorde crashed in the early evening. Bad timing for a Times leader writer who'd already written about
it. I think it was late afternoon.
I'd already found my piece about the coup in Fiji. It was unfortunate timing. Now, but nevertheless, the Times cleared space and wrote instant commentary on the Concorde crash, what it meant for a Concorde, what it meant for the air industry generally, what it meant for the wider travel industry. A colleague of mine who was working at a leading German newspaper at the same time, and sadly most of those who were killed on that Concorde crash were German. The news came through at the same time, but they decided not to cover it because they were all going home that evening, and it would have to wait for another day.
Wow.
Now, this keeps in mind that the fact that the Times didn't cover the Hiroshima attack in 1945 because they needed 45 hours to think about what it really meant. And in some ways, you know, why shouldn't they take time to think about such a momentous event before commenting instantly? Are we all commenting instantly because we have to? And actually, we make ourselves journalists, but not historians, in doing so.
So I mean, slightly unusual background for a journalist. I was a computer scientist at university, and the significance of that is that I was one of the few people in the mid-90s who was on the internet at his desk all day long. I mean, even in newspapers, people weren't. And I was, because I was in a computer science lab. And I remember in sort of 95, 96, 97, my personal appetite for news at that point and for political news was limitless. And I was sat there on what news websites there were, just refreshing. I was doing my thesis during the 97 election, and my appetite for political news in the 97 election was far beyond anything that, you know, sort of the Press Association and The Guardian, which I think were basically the two websites, I think The Times had a website as well, that you could access and could supply. I sort of type a bit of code and then come back and see whether anything happened in the last half hour. So in a strange way, I feel like that I was in 1997, where everyone else is now, that you sort of, you people just want lots and lots and lots and lots of news and analysis, and the problem is that very often in the first hour after something happens there isn't very much news and analysis because you don't know what's happened. And you know, you sort of, even things that have happened on camera, think about sort of 9/11, about the Concorde crash, which was captured on camera. I think you're in those early hours, there isn't very much, very often, that you can say. And very much of what you will say is wrong. I mean, having been sort of working in the Mirror in during 9/11, and one of the things I'm keenly aware of is that almost an awful lot of the stuff that we reported in the first 24 hours, and this is not a judgment on anyone, it was incorrect. I think we massively overestimated death toll, because how the hell do you know? Who knows how many people were in those towers? Nobody. That's not a known fact. On the 11th of September, you know roughly how many people worked there on an average day, but who was actually there in that moment? But the market, the appetite, is limitless, and on Twitter and on sort of on live blogs and all of these things, there's a desperate desire to have stuff. Quite reasonably, I sort of everyone wants to know everything all at once. And I mean, having done a few breaking news events, having sadly done a few terrorist attacks in the last 5 years, one of the things you're acutely conscious of is it would be better if everyone sort of left it and waited until tomorrow, and then we'd know how many people had been killed. You know, I can't tell you now, and I won't be able to tell you in 1 minute, and I won't be able to tell you in 2 minutes, and I won't be able to tell you in 3 minutes, and so please, maybe you should stop refreshing. But that doesn't really work for readers. And
Rob, yeah. I mean, one of the interesting things about you is you are a journalist, but also a historian. So you've written, for example, about Agent Jack, a Cornish bank clerk who was an agent provocateur to entice fascist-minded British people to spill their beans about what they were doing to help the Third Reich during the Second World War. Do you find that the role of the historian is different to the role of the journalist? The historian has huge advantage. Hindsight, access to archives that journalists don't have. How has it shaped your ability as a journalist to think, I have instant information, but is it accurate?
I think the thing that I realised doing that was, again, actually, I mean, something I slightly knew, which was how uncertain information is. And you're reading files that people were writing contemporaneously, you're reading people's diaries that they're writing contemporaneously, and you're sitting there thinking, well, I know at 70 years distance, actually, you're wrong about this. You don't need to worry about this, or you do need to worry about that. And I can understand that from where you're sitting, actually round the corner from here, in St. James's, in MI5 headquarters, it then was, this thing here looks like a tremendous problem, but actually, at a distance of 70 years, nobody is going to think that was the biggest problem facing the government. You know, whether it's British fascists or whether it's Italian waiters, huge worry in mid-1940 about all the Italians in Britain and whose side they were on and what should be done with them, and which at our distance looks absolutely ridiculous. But you can see that in mid-1940, having just declared war on Italy, it's also a stupid thing to worry about. So that, I think, made me sympathetic to people wrestling with problems, with uncertain information, with incomplete information. I mean, the great frustration as a historian is you don't have access to the people, so you only have what they wrote down. With that, Agent Jack in particular, the issue was that it was even for an MI5 operation, it was a secret operation, it was a secret within MI5. And so very, very few people had written anything down about it. And you were sort of constantly sort of searching for oblique references to this operation, trying to work out what people were talking about. And MI5 was sufficiently embarrassed about it that after the war there was a fairly comprehensive destruction of most of the records relating to it, which made it more difficult, and none of the people involved in it ever talked about it, which made it more difficult. Whereas with journalism, very often you sort of, it's not difficult to get people to talk, although it's sometimes quite difficult to get the people who know what's going on to talk. It's quite easy to get people who don't know what's going on to talk. I'm always quite sympathetic to people in government. It may not come across in sketches, but I am actually quite sympathetic to people who are wrestling with difficult problems. We're writing this in an age of COVID. I am very sympathetic to the government wrestling with the enormous, impossible challenges that they have to face with, you know, sort of locking down versus...
Well, let's come to your career as a sketch writer for The Critic. What are your inspirations? Is it novels, comic novels, the great British history of satire, which, let's be honest, Parliament lends itself to majestically. Are you drawing on the great speeches of Fox and Burke and Disraeli and Gladstone?
Well,
what's your motivation?
I'm a computer scientist. I'm not a historian, so I'm sadly lacking in that kind of context. I grew up reading The Times, where Miles Kington had a daily column. I mean, a daily column, which was always funny. And when I was about 13, he switched to The Independent, which I think had then just launched, and I started buying The Independent on the way to school simply to read Miles Kington's column. And then I would bring it home and give it to my mum. And that was our shared pleasure, was Miles Kington. In my late teens, I, as teenagers do, started reading The Guardian, where at that stage Simon Hoggart was the columnist, and Simon Hoggart's sketch was the first thing I would read every day. Simon absolutely was, for me, the model. And I wrote amateur sketches for my student newspaper at Edinburgh, and we all knew that was who we wanted to be, or I knew that was who I wanted to be. And I mean, when I moved here and started working for Bloomberg and found myself in Bloomberg shares an office with The Guardian in the weird way that the press gallery works, and so I found myself sharing an office with Simon, which was, for me, was the absolute highlight of my career. And I mean, I never obviously told him how much that meant to me, but sitting there and actually, the dirty secret of sketch writers, I feel I can reveal, is that you're absolutely desperate for anyone to give you jokes. So you would sit there and you would sort of, something would be happening and you'd say something and Simon would say, "Oh, I'll have that." And you'd think, yes, you know. Simon carried on writing. You know, we all knew that he was ill, and he didn't want to talk about it, so we didn't talk about it, which is very odd. So I never talked to him about what he meant to me. His sketches of the latter years of the Major government and the early years of the Blair government, for me, was the inspiration, completely. And that combined with Miles Kington mainly didn't do politics, but every now and then he would do sort of the Thatcher government as Macbeth, or just flights of fancy, and that was the other thing. I just loved, so the Miles Kington thing that has most stayed with me is he sort of observed one day that women liked romance and men liked war novels, and the solution to this was a publishing house that would write romantic war novels, and it would be called Mills and Bang. And then he would write little précis of these books of love on the Love in the Trenches and this kind of thing. And those have stayed with me for 30 years. And those are the things that I would love to write something as good as Mills and Bang.
Well, Rob Hutton, sketch writer for The Critic, on the prospect of Mills and Bang, we must leave it there.
If you've enjoyed listening to The Critic podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the offer of 3 issues for just £5 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.